Good evening, James McCanny here with My Science Hour, June 28, 2018. Many topics to cover tonight, including some listener emails. And that's how I interface with listeners. If you want to have a topic covered on the show, just email. You can find the email address on the webpage, jmccsci.com. The email address is jmcc@jmccannyscience.com. And I look at these and many times pick these topics because, as I learned when I used to teach in a classroom, if some student asked a question, probably two or three or more were thinking the same thing. So first topic, Eustace Mullins is a name you should get familiar with if you're not already familiar. He was a man who I think was born in 1923. He died, I think, in 2010. But this guy nailed it on the head. And I, through my own kicking around the world, let's just put it that way, being in many different countries and understanding how things worked and seeing things firsthand. And remember, when I talk about things on my show, when I do my science, this is because this is what I figured out. It's not because I read it on somebody else's webpage or in a book or whatever. But I would recommend going to the YouTube. There are many YouTube videos, and you know I don't like YouTube, but there's an interesting one. It's called The Cult of Baal versus the American Constitution. And just to give you an idea, he recognized very early on about the New World Order and about the Bushes and the Clintons and understanding that this was the banker world. And so I came at this from a very different side. I came at this from the science side of the world, recognizing this in the military-industrial complex, seeing it firsthand, and understanding, and then through my own estimates, that there is probably about 5,000 people in the world who manage things. And of those 5,000, the leaders of the countries of the G8 are prime people who then have their minions and staffs, etc., in countries like Germany and in France, in Canada, and the United States, and Russia. And remember, Russia was kicked out of the G8 because Putin went south on the bankers. He established his own banking system. He was in the BRICS nations. Remember, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And those countries broke away from the banks, and Putin nationalized his banking system, started reintroduced Orthodox Christianity into Russia as the, basically he is, he goes to an Orthodox church, and turned completely 180 on the bankers. So they threw him out of the G8. Trump comes into the G8, and they don't like Trump. The G8 is not Trump friendly, because he's not doing the party line. It was the Obamas and the Clintons and the Bushes going way back, all the way back to literally the assassination of Kennedy, that were doing the bidding of the bankers. But Eustace Mullins, go in and listen to his dialogue, and just very important, is Eustace is spelled E-U-S-T-A-C-E. And then Mullins, just like it sounds, M-U-L-L-I-N-S. And the one I liked was the Cult of Baal versus American Constitution, because I've talked about Baal before, and how this character of ancient Babylonia is being worshipped by the elites in the United States, in Bohemian Grove, for example. And you have to understand, this is what the deep state is all about. It's not some group of people that just happen to form in the United States on their own and you know, take over power. And no, these people are corrupt from the core. These are people that have taken political gain to a new level, political, personal gain, but they are the wheels and the cogs of the big machine that operates under this worldwide control network. And so when Putin split from that, they threw him out of the G8. Now it's called the G7. And they're really, really upset with Trump. But there's a big surge in the world taking over once again. Italy, just many of the Eastern European countries voting in conservative leaders who are stopping the illegal immigration, which is designed to take these countries and tear them apart. And that's what it's all about. There's no way these countries, they, in Europe nor the United States, there's no way that they can, or the United States, can accept all of the immigrants. I talked about this yesterday morning on John Moore's show, where Mexico doubled its population three times in the last 30 years. Every 10 years, Mexico doubles its population, and that's with a mortality rate of 50% for children under age 10. So when they come to the United States, they don't have that mortality rate, but they're still having babies. Every 13-year-old girl already has a baby. And that's their ticket to ride, they believe. That's their belief. And so the point is that between Mexico and the United States, there's three countries in the world that are billion, or two in the world that are billion population countries. There's China, there's India, and then the United States has the third highest population in the world, and we have officially 324 million people. It's probably closer to 400, but Mexico is probably pushing 150 million now. They don't really keep a decent census. The last real census was probably about 8 years ago, at 2010. They said it was 107 million, and that has probably close to doubled at this time. So between the United States and Mexico, there's a half a billion people here. And literally, and it's not due to the United States native population that was here 10 years ago. It's strictly due to immigrant overpopulation. So that says that within the next 10 years, we're going to be pushing a population of 700 to 800 million people in this country. It can't happen. There's not enough room. And the massive explosion of population, it's in Africa, quite a few countries. There's the Mid East, quite a few countries. And, of course, China and India are just going crazy. But really, we don't have a lot of influx from China and India. We do in the sense of technicians working in industries where they're what you call contractors. But the Mexican population that's coming in have typically no skills. And the problem is the expansive, explosive population growth that we can't handle. And most of this population growth in Mexico and in the population in the United States, our kids under 10 years old, they're not visible on the radar. So, okay, just going back to Eustace Mullins, I would suggest going and looking at his work, his tremendous volume of work, and read it and get a good education, because this guy is 100% right on. A little discussion on this past week, Bozo Science coming out again. You know, there's dark matter and dark energy, which are items that they can't define. They can't tell you what they look like or how you would even measure them in a universe which, because of broken cosmology, they design dark matter and dark energy as things that are necessary. Dark matter as a perceived necessity of the fact that galaxies don't rotate according to Newton's laws. So they invent dark matter, and I go through all of this in my DVD number 4, the downloadable one. I go through this entire argument of why that's bogus and it doesn't make any sense. But then they have dark energy, which they claim would explain the overexpansion of the universe, according to the Big Bang baloney. But now this past week, they're talking about lensing due to general relativity. And the article stated, this proves general relativity. Well, it doesn't. There is lensing going on, but it's due to the non-uniform electric fields that surround stars. So they have a star or a galaxy which is exactly aligned with some object that's in the back, and they get what they call Einstein rings. And that shows the bending of light. And I also describe this in my DVD number 4, which I recommend if you're interested in a high-level, university-level discussion of this topic. Get that DVD. I can't remember how much it is. It's on my webpage. But very important to understand that lensing is an electrical effect. So the problem here is that you have standard science and it's just dumped on you, the public. And there's, you know, this is going to go on for decades. So every now and then I try and throw a little something in to show you the baloney that's coming at you and then how I give you the correct information. Isn't that interesting on a free radio show? Next topic. Anthony Bourdain was allegedly died from suicide a week or two ago. He was an actor, world famous for his culinary prowess. Let's put it that way, in understanding food and good food. Many people followed this. He had just, I believe, was married. He was very happy. He had a daughter. Everything was going good. But as the word has it, now this is according to Alex Jones, who I believe in this case, that this was not a suicide. Now, there's something else you can look up on videos and online, is that these are called doorknob suicides. Now, that's a pretty strange term, but it's a signal. These people hung themselves on a doorknob, and that's a signal basically that they were killed because they were about to expose the, in this case, the pedophile and the human trafficking rings that are worldwide, but also concentrated in Hollywood. So, and then you see the mainstream media trying to figure out if he was depressed or trying to pick clues. He was shown at an interview where he said the meal he was eating was to die for, and he would probably never in his life eat something that good again. And they try and interpret this as him stating that he was going to commit suicide. Just complete baloney. So at any rate, Anthony Bourdain, my read on this, was not a suicide. He was murdered because he was about to go public regarding the Clintons and other Clinton issues, not the least of which is human trafficking. Which, by the way, is an essential part of the deep state. And so when you see Trump getting in there and routing this out, that's why these people are running scared, because their entire existence is about to be exposed. Just a little bit more on the Space Force, the Trump decision to open up space and create a sixth military division, or what you call agency or department, Department of the Air Force, there's Navy. And I've seen other people give some commentary. One was by Neil deGrasse Tyson, who I typically vehemently oppose and disagree with. But he had some very good points in that he said that besides the fact that we had signed a space treaty to not militarize outer space, that there were assets in outer space, very valuable assets, not the least of which is like GPS. And a lot of people didn't understand this, but GPS is used for commerce and for timing of commerce activity. So not only for location, et cetera, but and there are other assets up there that if we lost them, and maybe not only to hostile enemies, but to natural events, other types of events that there's so much dependency on these satellites, etc., that it's very important to protect them. But as here's one thing that Neil deGrasse Tyson had wrong, however. He said that up until now, the Air Force has been in charge of outer space. That's the visible space program. The invisible space program is handled primarily by the Navy. And so a lot of people don't know that, and a Tier 2 scientist like Tyson would not know this. And so he's, of course, promoting, that's why they like these Tier 2 scientists, they promote baloney, along with some good information, granted. But also, Trump is talking about rockets being the vehicle to get us into space. And in a sense, that's true, because when you want to get a heavy payload into space, rockets are the way to go today. But the runway to outer space and back to runway is the true way to go into outer space, even with heavy loads. And I talk about this a lot in my, if you want to hear more about this, I just got done with a series on propulsion systems in my paid cast. Very, very important, and that continues through this month of June. So go to my paid cast if you want to know more about propulsion systems, how to get into space, etc. But it's unfortunate that the governments of the world are militarizing outer space. And I've said before that if a country realizes that the less they put into military and the more they put into advancements and traveling farther and faster, while we're trying to build up this fort in three dimensions around planet Earth, they're going to be off to the far edge of the solar system and beyond, where our military really can't go because they have to lug along all of this military hardware. So, and there's the concept too that, and I talk about this in the Diamond Principle, that we are not ready to go into outer space. There's an old expression, you don't take a knife to a gunfight. And that's what we're doing if we go into outer space and encounter, which we may do. We may, in fact, encounter alien forces. And believe me, their pop guns are going to be a lot more big, a lot bigger and more advanced than ours. So I would suggest that you don't try to go up and belly up to the bar, so to speak, with aliens. Not a good idea. But anyway, so be it. I can understand the aspect of protecting assets in space. But to try and raise militarism, the problem there is it's one-upmanship. If we do it, then the Chinese and the Russians will do it, and then we have the same thing up there as we have down here. Plus, the problem which I explained a week ago, and this is in my book, The Diamond Principle, that you cannot develop militarism in outer space because it's three-dimensional. And the problem with three-dimensional growth is that even in two dimensions, in my book, The Diamond Principle, I point out that the Roman Empire, for example, got out to be too big and it could not support its gains out at the edge of its empire. And that's why Rome actually crumbled, because the emperor and his Senate back at Rome didn't realize that out at the fringes of the empire, the Roman army was not doing very well. They did pretty good because up to a certain point as they grew out of Italy and into Europe. But as they got up into the Black Forest, as they got up into Spain and Europe and down into the Mideast, they started losing their foothold because they couldn't grow in two dimensions. And you even find this like with ancient civilizations, let's say Xerxes, who was a ruler, and Alexander the Great. All of these great empires fell because of expansionism, of growing too big for your britches. Okay, this next story, I'm going to go into a few different countries and talk about privatization of water. Now, what does that mean? Remember, a number of years ago, Ireland had a big fight over the privatization of water, where people would have to start paying for water that they had owned since time immemorial. This time, Mexico, the title of the article is that while Mexico was celebrating their win against Germany in the World Cup, the president Nieto of Mexico was giving away their water rights. And this is, according to the article that occurred, give this the correct reference here, it's called blacklistednews.com, article 66604. What a strange number for the article, 66604 in blacklistednews.com. But anyway, he says, in fact, they source this as Telesur TV, which is, I believe, a Mexican television station. But there are 300 areas of surface water in Mexico, and you can imagine that Mexico surface water is a premium, that 55% of the Mexican surface water has been given to companies, including companies in mining, fracking, and the oil industry for the next 50 years. And so the apparently 10 decrees by the president published on June 5th and take 295 out of the 756 decades-long prohibitions on extracting water from previously protected basins. And so what they're basically doing is giving these water rights over to private corporations. So that is the term privatization. This also occurred in other countries in Latin America, Argentina, Brazil, other Latin American countries, where they literally gave away the water rights to foreign companies. The Rio Magdalena in Colombia being given away to European concerns a number of years ago, and these foreign companies come in and literally own the water. Yes, there are groups, this is an interesting name, Pedro Montezuma's, a spokesperson for a group called Water for All, claiming that this is a robbery of the people, which it of course is. The water rights belong to the country and ultimately to the people. So this is, once again, the international banking crowd. Remember that when George Bush, I, by the way, have a book, it's called Water. It's an ebook that I send out for free, where anybody who buys any products on my webpage typically gets this for free, especially if you're buying books, you get this for free. But the talks about the world water situation when George Bush Sr. quit being president and handed over the torch to Bill Clinton, his good longtime drug buddy, drug dealing buddy. George Bush Sr. went up to Canada and worked with the Royal Bank of Canada to basically obscure and then obtain the water rights all over the Western Hemisphere, both North America and South America. And so now we see this in Mexico. So this is a worldwide issue, where this is one of the things I really don't like about especially geologists. They work for governments, they work for the big corporations, they identify resources, and then these big corporations come in and get those resources basically given to them, and basically for almost nothing, as in this case, simply given. And of course, you can better bet your bottom peso that there was a lot of pesos going under the table to Nieto and his cabal that operates and owns and runs Mexico. So, leaving, and of course the Mexicans are trying to scramble across the border just because there's nothing there for them. And that's nothing new. This has been going on in Mexico for decades. But the problem with the border is with the doubling of the Mexican population, there's just not enough room anymore. There was a time when, say, my ancestors came to this country. They were giving away farmland because they did not have enough. They didn't have enough people to go out there and farm. Well, now it's a different situation. The United States is a fairly heavily populated country, third most populous country in the world. Another email from a listener about illiteracy. I'm going to read this email so you can get the tone of what this listener is talking about, because I talk about education or the lack thereof in the public school system, and the fact that they make kids sit at these desks from kindergarten to 12th grade. They all learn from the same standardized textbooks, and they call this education. It's absurd. Okay, so I'm going to read this email and then do a little discussion. It says, "Dear Professor, one of the things that I have fought with my wife all these years and related to our children and the public school system, this is in, I won't say specifically where, but it's in Illinois, is what I believe lies at the foundation of our country's failure. It is the lack of use of the most elementary books, and they are the dictionaries. Kids are not using them, are not encouraged to use them. Our kids are illiterate, and they have been made illiterate. I will skip the details, but tell you that without the grades, without the education, having a dream of being a professional baseball player and then having shattered that with an injury, I had to reinvent my life." And so he goes on telling about how he eventually ended up with his current career. But the point is, at the end, he says, "It is literacy that allowed me to learn the subject of real economics and allowing for the success that I've had to this day, even with recent health issues. Literacy is the first order of the day after family system." And so says, "Keep inspiring us." So interesting that literacy allows you, and this is something I've done many times in my life, I've expanded into many fields that I simply came upon and became interested in. Remember when I was, for example, starting out with electronics and I worked in the computer industry off and on, I actually taught computer science and electronics at advanced levels. This is after post high school in various capacities, university or other post high school venues. And it's something I learned about in college, but you know, the state of computers today is totally different, but I kept up with it. And so it's important to be able to learn as you go. Unfortunately, with a lot of people, say PhDs in astronomy, they read their textbook 20, 30 years ago, got an A, got their PhD, and that's the last real thought they had. They're still stuck in that 30-year-old textbook, which has nothing to do with real data and real data interpretation. So anyway, this person's point is that literacy after family values should be the number one thing that we teach our kids, and they should be with dictionaries. Now, I'll give a little twist to this. I spend time in foreign countries, and people always ask me, how can I learn English, as if there's some magical solution? And I said, okay, the first thing you do is you get a dictionary that's in your language and in English, and typically half of the book is English to that language, the other half is that language to English. So you open it up and you mark all the words that are similar. So if you're dealing with, say, the Romance languages, Italian or Spanish or French is a little different, but what you can do is mark these words that are similar. And if you go through the whole dictionary, there's probably, let's say there's 1,000 of them. That gives you a vocabulary right off the top of about 1,000 words, very common words that we use in everyday life. And in English, the computer industry worldwide uses English because the computer industry was born in English. It was developed in English. And so you have to learn typically the English words to really talk intelligently about computers, because the words don't, there is no translation of these words. So, but becoming literate, you can learn and expand and then find new employment and expand your life. You can enjoy things, but kids are not being taught to be literate today. They're spending time on phones and chats and tweets of, you know, short duration, and the attention span is something that's also failing. So not only literacy, this is my own commentary, that attention span is failing in our education system, is not allowing people, or the just the way in society is today, so not allowing kids to have decent attention spans. When I studied mathematics and physics when I was in high school, I had a desk, and of course this is in Minnesota. In the wintertime, you can hear a pin drop. It's so quiet on a quiet winter's night. Sit up in my room, and there was no place to go. And so I buried myself in my physics and mathematics, and this took long periods of concentration, and that ability to concentrate helped me as I went through college be on the top of my game and the top of the physics classes and mathematics classes that I was in. So, you know, hours and hours and hours of concentration and mental time when I was able to concentrate without interruption. Today, kids can't be 2 minutes without being interrupted by a text or a show or an advertisement. It's just insane. So concentration, attention span has been destroyed. And if you can destroy the attention span of people, in fact, there's a play on this. Kurt Vonnegut has a play, I think it's called The Monkey House, in which people, it's a play on modern society and political correctness. And the idea is that since we cannot, and in the concept of over-fairness or over-political correctness, that since we cannot bring all of the low IQ or retarded people up to the level of the well-educated person, we have to bring the well-educated person down to the level of the lowest person. And that's the so-called pun intended or tongue-in-cheek of this book. But to do that, what they do is they put a bleeper in everybody's ear. And every 15 seconds, this bleeper goes off and clears all of your thoughts from your brain. And that gets you down so that everybody is equal. It's called, I believe it's called The Monkey House, a Kurt Vonnegut short story. But it just shows that that is where society is today. You cannot do, unfortunately, I see this in a lot of foreign societies where the families, there's just constant influx of information and people and coming in and talking and watching TV, and somebody's always got the TV on, somebody's always got the telephone, and you know, it's just there's no concentration span developed at all. People don't have more than a 5 to 10 second attention span. In fact, they have to dumb down the commercials to that point, to where they are only 15 seconds long, because people don't even have enough attention span to watch a 1 minute advertisement on TV anymore. Just have one more announcement. I'll be jumping into the main science topic tonight, which will be dealing with the heating of the surface of the sun. And this is prompted by an article that came out this past week. But there were two articles. These were actually sent in by listener. One is, I got a kick out of this one. They're talking about charging aircraft, airplanes, to prevent lightning. Now, if you took a metal spacecraft and put it in up in the atmosphere in a zone where there was lightning or atmospheric conditions going on, and you put a charge on it, believe me, it would be more apt to discharge or become part of an electrical discharge than if it were not charged, because the skin of most airplanes is metal. And so what happens is, just like the bug killer, the backyard bug killer that I talk about in my example for the plasma discharge comet model, any object, conductive or non-conductive, that you put into an electric field, like the vertical electric field that occurs, which is exaggerated when you have a thunderstorm, it's going to discharge that capacitor, and especially if it's metal, because what happens with metal is that the electrons are free to move. They move up to the side near the positive side of the capacitor that the plane is flying in. And that little differential of charge is enough to trigger all of the current to go where the airplane is. So the airplane, by its presence in the electric field in the thunderstorm, actually causes the lightning to go where the plane is. And it's said that every major airplane that's flying, sometimes 7,000 airplanes in the air at one time per day, that those airplanes, all of them get hit by lightning all the time, but there's one major strike per year on average per airplane. So that's a lot. I mean, imagine that you're in an airplane, and what they try to do is fly the airplanes around the storms to minimize this, but still there's just a lot of atmospheric electricity. But the other thing is, how do you charge an airplane that's in flight? And that's, once again, basically an impossibility. You had to charge up something. You have to remove charge of one type, plus or minus, by some means to make this aircraft charge up. And so whoever was writing this article completely, you know, they talk about charging something up like, oh yeah, you just plug it into the wall and it charges up like a battery. I mean, this is the pathetic level of science. And of course, you see the authors of these articles are just bubble-headed people out of school somewhere, that most of them do not have any real science background. They're in, like, you know, I don't know, other fields, let's just put it that way. And they're trying to write about science issues. So anyway, on to the main science topic tonight, dealing with the surface heating of the sun. Now, when I was doing my original work long time ago, I realized that the core fusion model of the sun could not possibly be correct. There was 10 things that can tell you that could not possibly be true at all. Let me just give you a few simple examples. When I was in college, one of our physics problems, thermodynamics and other types of problems, we would do a calculation. And at that time, this was in the 60s, we really didn't have satellites that had a good view of the sun yet. And the Earth-based equipment, it was just very granular. We really did not have good vision, good data on the surface of the sun. And so what you would do, here's a physics problem. You have the core of the sun, it's estimated to be so big, and it's surrounded by hydrogen, primarily hydrogen atmosphere, that is compressed, of course, because of gravity. Gravity's holding it together. And allegedly, the compression of the hydrogen core was so great that it would kick off nuclear fusion, the fusing of hydrogen low atomic mass atoms in the core of the sun. And of course, this then would give off the heat that would radiate outwards and eventually reach the surface of the sun. But what happens is an X-ray leaves an atom, and that's the energy being given off by fusion. And in this core, the atoms are crushed together, so close together, that X-ray only flies a super short distance, and then it is absorbed and it re-emits. So this becomes what is known as the random walk. This is a statistical average, and the way the problem works out is basically it's the same as if you take a coin and you flip a coin, and you flip it once, you might have heads or tails. You flip it twice, you might have two heads, you might have two tails, or you might have a heads and a tail. But if you flip the coin enough times, you will statistically have 50% heads and 50% tails. The probability that you're going to have, say you flip the coin 100 times, the probability that you're going to flip it and it's going to be heads 100 times in a row is pretty small. I mean, it's possible. But statistically, you're going to have 50 times heads and 50 times tails. And if you do it a million times, that coming out to 50% becomes an even greater possibility that you're very close to 50%. So the idea is that the time it takes for the X-ray to migrate by this emission and absorption and re-emission and reabsorption, etc., zillions of times, by the time you get up to the surface of the sun, as this energy works its way out by the random walk, the surface of the sun should be absolutely a smooth orange ball with no surface structure at all. And there should be nothing magnetic or electric about it. So by the time, 10 years later, after I graduated from college, having that, you know, bank of information along with me, and then by then you could start to see surface, there was data coming in that actually showed surface features of the sun to be granular, and the sunspots and the solar wind, all the information about the solar wind was coming out. None of this could be possible with a core fusion model of the sun. I mean, it just, and I could go on about all the different reasons that by then there had been redshifting visible from the edges of the sun, all kinds of properties that would just not happen if the core fusion model of the sun were true. And so for, you know, let's say there were 20 good reasons to show that that was not true. And I used to go up and I would talk to a guy named Hans Bethe when I was at Cornell. He was the guy responsible, won a Nobel Prize for talking his work on the fusion models for solar activity. But anyway, there were serious problems with the core fusion model of the sun. So where was the fusion happening? Well, it was up at the surface, and when the Voyager and the spacecraft finally got to Jupiter and Saturn, the data was unequivocal that there was basically a flow like the solar wind coming off of Jupiter and Saturn. So Jupiter and Saturn were acting like small stars. So that was one of the clues that I realized that the sun's fusion was also in its atmosphere, because Jupiter and Saturn were small, unlit stars. They had exactly the same atmospheric composition as the sun, and they were acting the same except on a much less energetic scale. So at any rate, the reason I'm talking about this is this past week, an article came out in talking about what are known as Alphen waves. And these are, Hans Alphen won the Nobel Prize for discussing a type of energy transfer known as Alphen waves. These are waves in plasma which are observable. So now scientists have studied the movement of Alphen waves in sunspots. And these are typically regions where the solar wind comes pouring out. And they noticed that there were ripples, magnetic ripples. And you basically look at this by looking at the spectrum of the atoms that are down in that sunspot region. And you can tell the magnetic fields because of the splitting. It's called the Zeeman effect, and there's other effects also. The splitting of the lines of the spectrum because of the electric and magnetic fields in that region. And so by taking samples of this every couple minutes, they could see the movement of the energy. And so they claimed that Alphen waves were then producing the energy that heated up the corona, which is one of the strange properties of the sun. If you see a solar eclipse, for example, where the moon comes between Earth and the sun, And this past summer, there was a solar eclipse, and a lot of people went to see it. I didn't. I tried to stay away from the crowds. But at any rate, what you would see is kind of like these rays that are sticking out from the sun. Well, that's the corona, and it's basically a sea of relativistic electrons that surrounds the sun. And that's a perfect example of something that could not possibly exist with a purely gravitational sun. So I talk about all of this in my original work and my original published papers. And so this is work that I really pioneered, is the surface fusion of the sun. And this is not a heating due to electric currents hitting the sun. This is not like an anode where you have electrical currents coming into the solar system. Those types of models could not possibly be true, because if there were big electrical currents coming into the solar system enough to power the sun to the level we see it, then the Earth and Jupiter and all the other planets would be, Mercury, Venus, would all be French fried, basically, because of this tremendous current, because electrical currents tend to find an object and flow along the path of that object. So the Earth would not be here. It would be totally scorched. Venus, Mercury, Mars would all be totally scorched by these electrical currents that allegedly would be enough to power the sun. So that's not the source of the energy of the sun. It could not possibly be true. So the only issue is that, where does the sun get enough hydrogen to continue burning for this period of time? But back to this study that was released, talking about they're realizing that there is energy up in the surface of the sun, but they still keep using this core fusion model of the sun, not realizing that every time they make another step, stating that there's some kind of a change in the atmosphere of the sun, they are stepping one step closer to denying that the core could be the possible source of fusion. If you can see this dichotomy, this contradiction, they contradict the very core results, the very rudimentary results of the core fusion model, which is the surface should be a smooth orange 6,000 degree ball of gas with no surface, with no solar wind, with no electrical effects, no solar corona, solar wind, and especially not a differential solar wind where there's charging involved. There would be no electrical conditions around Earth. There would be no magnetic tail of Earth. None of this would happen in a core fusion model, with a core fusion model of the sun. So when they start talking about Alfvén waves, it's almost like they're using some magical term, like we could call it the kitchen sink theory, that because, you know, some magical form of energy. A lot of times they talk about magnetic energy or magnetic energy, and it's really not true, because magnetic fields only exist because there are electric currents in some place. Magnetic fields don't just simply exist on their own. It's something that I pointed out in my very earliest work. So once again, standard science seems to march off in these odd directions, blatantly contradicting the theories that they're basing this on, and without even realizing it. So wanted to give you a little bit of a discussion here. And then if we talk about weather in the solar system, say weather on Jupiter or weather on Saturn or weather on planet Earth or weather on Venus, you have to understand the interaction of the weather of these planetary bodies, or in the case of Jupiter and Saturn, you have to understand that these are small stars. They have their local electric fields, and then they also exist in the larger scale electric field of the whole solar system. And even the sun and its planets, of which we are one, are moving in the galactic wind. It's like the solar wind. It's a proton wind that's in the greater galactic region where our solar system lies. And so we are literally discharging that. So the sun literally is a comet. And so where does the hydrogen come from? It comes from outer space because the sun is literally acting as a comet. So that's one of the beauties of the plasma discharge comet model, is it explains every place from every electrical effect from the around the smallest dust particle all the way up to the sun. And even on the galactic scale, quasars are small objects that are have a high proton wind coming off of them, but a lot of them are associated with major galaxies where you can see the electrical discharge between the quasar and the mother galaxy core, and those are visible. That's what Halton Arp did. He spent many years of his life examining the electrical connections between quasars and galaxies, proving that quasars are not something that's distant in the far regions of the universe, but are very close and are associated with standard galactic types. You can see the little arms. In fact, this is a good exercise if you have a few extra minutes, rather than going to some YouTube video about recent news or something. Go there and look up Halton Arp, A-R-P, and then show pictures of the galaxies which he identified as being related, galaxies and quasars. There's should be vast amount of pictures on the internet that you can pick up and look at those photos. So the idea is that the fusion-based capacitors, they're around the galaxies, they're around the stars, they're around planets, not really planets, but small unlit stars like Jupiter and Saturn, and they have their own little, basically, solar systems with electric fields. So just a little diversion there. And I noticed Trump, in his speech when he was talking about the Space Force, he was insistent that they understand space correctly, have a good basic theoretical understanding of outer space. But the problem is that the basically NASA has no clue about how outer space works. These Tier 2 scientists have absolutely no clue what's going on out there. They don't understand radiation, where it comes from, what's the cause of radiation, and they certainly don't understand how to cure it or mitigate it, at least. They don't understand that there's no such thing as a ozone hole, a hole in the ozone layer. I mean, it just goes on and on. So, unfortunately, Trump depends on his people. He's not a scientist, and it's unfortunate. I wish we would have a president who would understand a little bit about science so I could sit down and explain. They're busy, you know, he's busy with tons of other things. But to explain the situation with science, how the internet is filled with quacks, and Tier 2 science is filled with quacks. And he's somewhere in the middle trying to make sense out of this and create a stable scientific base for this country. But he's going to depend on his people, and it's unfortunate. I would like to get his ear for a bit to just go through the laundry list of baloney that is NASA. And I think he smells it, but he really doesn't know what it is or certainly what to do about it. And I would take care of NASA in about one pen stroke and just annihilate that whole agency. Annihilate in the sense of disband them. And I just want to remind you now that my paid cast, $3.95 a month. And by the way, if you're looking to get some of my books, I have half price book deals for the ebooks on my paid cast. So if you sign up for the paid cast, you also get a real good deal on my books. And so that's on the webpage, jmccsci.com. Remember the water filters, JMCC water filters. And if you're thinking about buying a water filter, I'm on radio shows all the time and they're advertising water filters. Ask this question. Do you have to buy an extra filter for arsenic and fluoride? Two things you definitely want to take out of your water. And if you look at any other brand, literally any other brand of water filter on the market, they do not remove fluoride nor arsenic. And mine do. Mine are the only filters that remove arsenic and fluoride in the filter itself. And so I used to sell those add-on filters along with the old Dalton filters, which I don't sell anymore. But the add-on fluoride and arsenic filters are only good for about 500 gallons of water, whereas your water filter is, the main filter element is capable of filtering a lot more water. So when you add up the price of the add-on filter elements, there's just no comparison. My filter elements, including arsenic and fluoride removal, cost less than the add-on filters for the other brands. So that just gives you an idea. My biggest selling product is replacement filter elements. Now, of course, have the Imperial water filter elements that are twice the diameter, have four times the surface area, so the water flow is four times as fast. You only have to use one. In fact, even of the standard size filter elements, I only use one. I would encourage you to also buy a filter element, or if you have some at the house there, take one with you when you travel in case of emergency, because you can take any container, punch a hole in the bottom, put in the filter, and you have yourself an emergency water filter simply by carrying along an extra water filter element in your suitcase. And they go through Homeland Security checkpoints, not a problem. And if they ever ask you, just say, that's my water filter. And so that's for emergency water filtration, and you can, they understand what it is. So anyway, the paid cast, the water filter elements, I'm still taking names of people who are interested in wing generator, all on my webpage, jmccsci.com. And I encourage people, the paid cast, this past month I've been talking, in fact, I've had 8 different lectures on just the book Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, probably my biggest selling book of all time, because of the initial tremendous sales that came from that book release, which was back in, I believe it was about 2003. But so much additional information that I'm giving in these paid casts. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.